Bearing witness in Syria. Today, Wednesday, February 26th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The BBC's Lise Doucette says she goes to Syria's besieged cities to bear witness. And she says it's clear that starvation is being used as a weapon of war.
Even in war, there are rules. And one of the rules is that civilian populations should not be punished. And it's happening. It's happening every day in Syria.
We'll hear about the hunger afflicting residents in one devastated area in Damascus. Also today, major league players from Venezuela worry about the violence back home. And later, how Mexican mole was invented, not by chefs, but by nuns in convents, using what they had on hand.
Chilies that are completely indigenous to Mexico. Almonds brought in by the Spaniards. Cinnamon from Sri Lanka.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. War is hell. It's easy to make a statement like that from a safe distance, but some of the images coming out of Syria clearly back those words up. I recently saw a BBC video report from Syria that was especially haunting. The place was a Palestinian refugee camp just outside Damascus. And what you see is an endless sea of gaunt and grim faces, desperate for food, crammed between bombed-up buildings and huge piles of rubble. The report was by the BBC's Lise Doucette, and we're going to hear from her in a moment. First, some quick facts. This area of Yarmouk was first built as a refugee camp for Palestinians fleeing the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. Over the years, it became a more permanent neighborhood. Now, though, it's become a battleground in Syria's brutal civil war. Rebel fighters reportedly moved into the camp at some point. Government forces bombed in response. Many residents fled. But some remain trapped there, and a deal to allow food deliveries into the camp recently fell through, which is why Lise Doucette, who's been covering the Syrian war for the BBC, decided to visit Yarmouk. And what she saw left a deep impression on her.
This ghostly corridor, this road leading into Yarmouk, was not just that every single building was completely gutted. It was that there was a tide of people waiting in this narrow alleyway, a road of ruins. And the world, including Syrians, are shielded from what is happening inside. And going into Yarmouk that day was a lesson to me that no matter how many images you see uploaded onto YouTube and other social media sites, no matter how many photographs you see, it still does not prepare you for the shock of this when you actually enter and see it with your own eyes, feel it yourself. You cannot help but be moved by the plight of people. It was shocking, absolutely shocking. The United Nations officials we traveled with were shocked. And the people people came lunging toward us thinking that we worked for the United Nations, begging and pleading for us to somehow help them to get out. This is on the edges of Damascus, a very, 20-minute drive away from the center where the fountains are splashing with water, where the gardens, the parks are tended, where people are suffering from the war in every part of Syria. But there are some parts where you could be forgiven for thinking there wasn't really a war. People go about their daily lives with difficulty and with danger, but they don't have to live under the conditions that we saw in Yarmouk.
You met a father and his 20-something daughter in Yarmouk. They hadn't seen each other for over a year. I guess that shows just how devastated the city is, but how is that possible?
One of the things which was so utterly heartbreaking in Yarmouk was how quickly people succumbed to tears. That grown men cried, this father who was reunited with his daughter. He just couldn't help him. He was just beside himself. He was rubbing his eyes. The tears were flowing. The tears on his daughter's face were flowing. We saw children crying, old women, young women. And you'd think it was as if a disaster had just struck and they were overwhelmed suddenly by the emotion and pain of what has happened. But these people have been living with the siege for 8 months. And the scene looked as if it was an earthquake, that an earthquake has struck, so deep and widespread was the destruction. But this was a man-made earthquake, the result of a life where there's been daily shelling, there's been bombardment, fighting street to street. And the people were having to live with this day in, day out. We met one woman. Let me give you a concrete 60-year-old Wafika, bent with age, bent with pain. She said she needed a kidney operation. She almost fell over when she saw us, saying, please, please, take us out, take us out. We're dying here. And she thought we were from the United Nations and could get her out. And she was just, the tears, she just couldn't stop crying. She was sobbing. And then when we left about an hour later, we saw her coming behind us. And so she came up to us and thanked us. She said, you have helped me out. You have taken me out of hell. She said, I've been eating grasses. And she was clutching a piece of bread. She was so relieved to finally have bread. But her sadness had it ended, because she then started crying again to say, you know, I have 5 sons and 4 daughters, and 3 of my sons are still inside. And she talked about the children who were still inside. So even when you leave a siege, when you escape a siege, you can't escape the war, because the war isn't over.
Now, Yarmouk is an interesting case because it grew exponentially after Palestinian refugees flooded in after the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, right? So who lives there today?
This is the place where, as you say, the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, during the time of independence for Israel, there was a huge, of course, exodus of Palestinians. Some of them did go to Syria. And it grew over the decades to be the heart of the Palestinian community, the biggest community of Palestinian refugees in Syria, about 180,000 people. And it was a bustling neighborhoods with cafes and restaurants, and people were refugees, but they managed to have a life. They could work, they could get access to resources, they could get passports. The people we spoke to said, you know, why are we suffering? This is not our war. And this is our home. We have nowhere else to go. This is where all these children we saw were born. They are Palestinian origin, but they're Syrians now.
I mean, for years, President Assad has boasted about his support for Palestinian refugees and the Palestinian resistance against Israel. I mean, you'd think he'd make kind of Yarmouk a safe haven, and yet he's shelling it.
It's complicated by the fact that the armed Syrian opposition moved into the camp. And once they moved into the camp, it meant that the Palestinian camp was now part of the war. And so the Syrian government moved in, they started attacking, they started bombarding, and then eventually they cut it off with this surrender or starve policy, which sadly some people say is working because people are surrendering. There are the deals that are being made, not just in Yarmouk, but in other neighborhoods where people at the point of starvation, people so tired, so frustrated, so exhausted, say, right, let's make a deal. Let's find a way that we can maintain control and bring in food and medicine and some comfort to our families. So what's happening now is a very sensitive negotiations over Syrian armed opposition groups, the various groups, will pull out of the Yarmouk camp, and Palestinian groups who are allied to the Syrian government will go in to maintain order.
I mean, aside from just seeing more evidence of the horrors of Syria, why did you go to Yarmouk, Liz?
Why did I go to Yarmouk?
Yeah.
We tried for months to go to Yarmouk because it is fundamentally this brutal war and a worsening war is also a major humanitarian disaster. And if you want to see the consequences of the war, you have to go see what is happening to the people. And therefore, I think as a journalist who is still able to go to Damascus, able to get a visa, I think it is incumbent upon us to use the phrase to bear witness, to say to the world, you cannot say you don't know what is happening. Let us show you what is happening and let us ask our governments what they want to do about this. Starving a community is a war crime. And can it be allowed that this kind of tactic is used in the century in which we live, in which no one can say we didn't know it was happening? And the former British Foreign Secretary, who is now heading the International Rescue Committee, which is an American NGO, put it this way. He said, if we cannot bring an end to the war, we should at least bring humanity to the conduct of the war, because even in war, there are rules. And one of the rules is that civilian populations should not be punished and should not be used as weapons, as ammunitions in this war. And it's happening. It's happening every day in Syria for now a few years.
The BBC's Liz Doucette, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you, Marco.
So spring training is in full swing as Major League Baseball gears up for opening day next month. But a sizable contingent of Major League players has something else on their minds, the deadly unrest in Venezuela. More than a dozen people have died in a wave of anti-government protests and crackdowns by government forces. There are a lot of Venezuelan players in U.S. baseball, and they're worried about the violence back home. Many of the players have been tweeting pictures of themselves holding the Venezuelan flag and signs urging peace in the country. Alfredo Villasmiel is following the story. He's a sports writer for Ultimas Noticias in Caracas.
It just started with the Tigers, with Miguel Cabrera and Omar Vizquel, getting a picture with the flag and the tag SOS Venezuela, or Estamos lejos pero no ausentes, but we are far but not absent, asking for peace. But every single day, two or three teams start to send a message of peace. It's not a division. It's just we want peace.
So you're saying they're not picking sides then?
Yes. The government thought that it was a manipulation of the Department of State of the United States of America to try to, to blame the government for the repression and all the bad stuff. But the players made it clear, this is because we love Venezuela. Venezuela, we are your voice. And all the players start to get pictures.
In pushing for peace, these Venezuelan baseball players in the States, it would seem that they are actually siding with people power. Does the Venezuelan government have good reason to fear that those baseball players in the U.S. are not their allies?
Well, yes, because they are the popular idols. And the government is, they sell themselves as a popular government, the government from the people. So when the idols like Miguel Cabrera, Omar Vizquel, Francisco Rodriguez, or Salvador Perez, or Pablo Sandoval show the discomfort with the situation, the government is not happy with it because they think the sportsman, the baseball players are with the process. And right now it's not like that. It is, we want peace. That's what they are asking for, peace.
So this is a really big deal when these baseball idols, as you say, speak out.
Yes, of course it's a big deal because they are huge. For instance, Miguel Cabrera is like the idol, the greatest idol of the nation. When Miguel Cabrera is hitting, all the people are talking about it. When Felix Hernandez is speaking, the whole nation is watching him on the television.
But can these tweets, Alfredo, really do anything to stop the violence?
This is a political solution, Marco. The only way to stop the violence is by dialogue.
What you're saying, though, Alfredo, is basically it's going to take more than tweets to bring this to a peaceful end.
Yes, of course. Well, Marco, I'm praying a lot. There are 17 people dead right now, confirmed. And the government just have declared 6 days off for carnival and laughing and happiness. They don't speak in public addresses. They don't speak about dead people. Tomorrow it's going to be a President Maduro is calling for a big table of negotiation. Let's see what happens. It's the only way. Mm. We have to negotiate with each other because otherwise this can be explode and be a worse riot than already is.
Well, maybe the dialogue will start there. Sports writer Alfredo Villasmiel with Venezuela's Ultimas Noticias speaking with us from Caracas. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Just ahead, who made the mole on PRI Public Radio International?
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Whole lot of games in Russia after the Winter Olympics. Then come the Paralympics, also in Sochi. But before that, today is the opening day in Russia for the Open Games. The Open Games are athletic events open to all, but they are being organized by LGBT rights groups. That means they're getting a frosty reception from officials in Russia and a lot of confusion on the ground. Reporter Charles Maines has been out and about in Moscow today looking for the opening ceremony. Have you found it yet, Charles?
I have, in fact, but it wasn't easy. It's been a little bit of a cloak and dagger evening. The opening ceremony was supposed to take place in one club where, in fact, a bomb threat was called in. Police then were investigating that bomb threat, but some of the people that I spoke with here say, in fact, that they felt that the police were actually slowing down that investigation on purpose. They've also had other problems. Some of the venues canceled on them for the sporting events, as well as some of the athletes who arrived have been kicked out of their hostels and hotels. So to say that it's going smoothly is certainly not the case.
So where are you right now?
They found an alternative venue. It's a club in downtown Moscow that's sort of generally known for being open to liberal politicians and other types. And the games are just getting started with the opening ceremony, making the opening speeches down in the basement here.
Mm. So what's all this about? I mean, is it just Russians trying to distance themselves from an event that they're worried about what it might suggest?
Well, the organizers say this is more about trying to meet the authorities halfway in light of the Sochi Games, which were praised by a lot of people for being, you know, showing this sort of open new Russia. They felt as this wasn't a challenge to the authorities to hold the open games, but a chance to kind of have a dialogue with them. Unfortunately, they're not having that dialogue as we've seen so far. But again, speaking to some of the people here, they say that they know what country they live in. They know that there are these problems. And so they have contingency plans that they put in place. Already they've found alternative venues for some of the sporting events tomorrow.
Yeah, so who's due to take part? Who has actually arrived for these games? And what kind of sports are we talking about?
Well, they've got 300 athletes, over 300 athletes, in fact, from 11 countries. We have North America represented. We also have Europe and also from 22 regions of Russia. They'll be taking part in games including skiing, basketball, swimming, tennis, and volleyball. That said, they're also going to have a lot of roundtable discussions about LGBT rights as well as a cultural program.
So are these games, these open games, being seen as kind of a counterpoint to all the anti-gay stuff that's been going on in Russia and, you know, some of the concerns at the Sochi Olympics?
I think so. I mean, you know, in the run-up to Sochi, there was certainly a lot of talk among the LGBT community, both internationally and within Russia, in terms of what to do about Sochi. You know, some people were calling for a boycott. Others were saying, you know, let sports be sports, and maybe now this isn't the time to protest the games. In the end, you know, I was just down in Sochi, and there really wasn't too much activity in terms of gay rights activists protesting. We had Pussy Riot down there, and they'd certainly been allied with the LGBT movement in Russia, but it basically was pretty quiet, and I think this is their moment to try and raise the issue again.
The organizers, though, must have known they were going to run into trouble. Does staging these open games violate any part of Russia's controversial gay propaganda law?
The organizers would argue no. In fact, they've got plus 18 signs. This means no minors allowed into the games, which would keep them abreast of the law for propaganda to minors in Russia.
Are any Russians or the Kremlin kind of making the point that this might be violating the gay propaganda law?
Well, it's not really clear exactly what's happened so far. I mean, they've had pressure from police. The migration services have gotten involved, making visits to some of the Russian athletes who've come in from out of town. But it's not really clear if this is coming on from on high. Certainly, there's been some noise made by lawmakers in St. Petersburg, in particular one Milonov, who's been sort of vehemently against the gay rights movement in Russia. They're certainly making their lives difficult. If this is coming up from way, way on high, it's hard to say.
Mm. I mean, a lot of attention is now on the crisis in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin today ordered military exercises across Western Russia. Do the activists at these games worry that their message is just going to be drowned out?
I think it's a valid concern. I think at this point, you know, their main goal is to just get these games on, and that's been enough of a challenge as we've seen so far.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks for telling us about this.
Thank you, Marco.
We heard earlier from Syria, where the civil war has been spreading death and misery for 3 years now. It's hard to believe that anything good could come out of such tragedy, but sometimes it does. It was through tragedy, for example, that Ayham Alfaris and Sanya Sawan came together. This is their story. Dozens in Sanya's extended family were killed in a massacre, reportedly by Syrian government forces. She was distraught and sought the help of activists to publicize what happened. That's when Ayham got a call in Istanbul, Turkey. He's a young journalist and opposition activist there.
I was here in Istanbul, and my friend called me here. And he told me, hey, Ayham, how are you? I have a friend that are in Syria, and they need help. I told him, okay, I will talk with her. We introduced each other. She told me about the massacre that happened for her, and she lost 60 of her family.
When we start talking about this story, my memory goes right back to the beginning, as if it's in front of me all over again. The massacre isn't something that can be forgotten. 125 people were killed, 60 of whom were from my family.
It was really very hard. After that, I give her my number and my real name. And I told her, if you need anything, you can call me.
It was the start of a new love, but our conversations were really painful.
Later, Sonia called Ayham to say there'd been another massacre, and while she begged him to help her and her parents get out of Syria, Sonia still wasn't sure she could trust Ayham.
I told her, I know it's hard to trust me, but as I told you before, if you want to survive your life, you have to trust me. You have to go with this man, don't ask him where you are going.
He would just look at us through the rearview mirror in the car, but he would not answer a single word.
I was sure that he would take them for the safest place. After that, she called me and she told me that this man take us for his house between his children. She told me, Ayham, we want to go where my sisters live. He took them to her sister's house, and they stayed there. I was very happy. I cried that day so much. She called me from there, and she told me, Ayham, I love you. That's it. Then she traveled to Egypt with her family. After that, I traveled to Egypt. We have got married in the 6th of December.
That was in December 2012. 1 month after their first anniversary, this past January, Ayham and Sonia had a baby boy. They say he's like a flower, a hopeful sign of Syria's rebirth. The family lives in Istanbul, where they were speaking with producer Dalia Mortada. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, we visit the halal meat aisle in Anaheim's Little Arabia neighborhood.
You have very acquired tastes like lamb tongue, kidneys. I know they have brains here. Oh, here it is.
Plus, remembering the genius of guitarist Paco de Lucia. First, the latest news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. After the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan, the meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant forced the country to rethink its energy strategy. The Japanese government promised to refocus on renewables and took nearly all of the country's 48 nuclear plants offline. They've been offline ever since. But this week, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government said Japan plans to restart many of its nuclear power plants, provided they meet strict new safety standards. The Wall Street Journal's William Sposato is in Tokyo. He says the government's new draft energy plan carefully avoids specifics in a country that's still deeply divided about nuclear power.
The government has said that what they want to do is have nuclear power as a primary resource, not the only one, of course, but they want to keep some nuclear power generating facilities. They have not said exactly what percentage that would be, and that's going to be a big question going forward. The decision is not really a surprise. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been pushing for nuclear power, although stressing the safety issues. But don't forget that Japan has to import nearly all of its energy needs. And so nuclear power has been seen in the past as a vital element, and it looks like it's going to come back to that again.
Now, it may not be a surprise to people in Japan, but for a lot of people around the world who, right after the Fukushima meltdown, heard that Japan was going to shift away from nuclear power, this does seem kind of surprising.
Yes, I mean, the safety issues are obviously there, and a lot of public opinion polls show that people are pretty much evenly split over whether the country should have any nuclear power generation at all. And so that has proven to be a political problem for the prime minister in trying to get these plants restarted.
How does this plan kind of fit into the overall debate post-Fukushima about future sources of Japan's energy?
Well, the plan does pave the way for greater use of renewable energy, solar and wind power. And there is some big money behind the renewable industry. SoftBank, Mr. Son, who is one of the most dynamic entrepreneurs in Japan, is putting a lot of money into solar plants. But in practical terms, energy experts say that when you add up the numbers, those sources are not really going to be able to make up for a lack of nuclear power, so that the only alternative for the country would be to continue to import very large amounts of fossil fuel, natural gas and oil.
But sitting there on the Ring of Fire, as Japan does, I mean, they can't really risk another earthquake-produced meltdown, can they? I mean, what kind of rigor will there be to make sure that these nuclear power plants are not going to melt down again?
The new Nuclear Regulation Authority, which was brought in after the Fukushima disaster, has vowed that it will be independent and has a brand new set of rules that it's holding plants to. The head of the NRA has said that plants need to be ready for any eventuality, not just the ones that they could likely expect to see. So the rules are certainly getting much tougher, at least on paper. But as you say, Japan is very earthquake prone.
So let's say, unpredictability of earthquakes aside, does this authority, this nuclear regulatory authority in Japan, does it really have teeth?
Well, I think that's an open question. The head of the agency has been very strong in saying that they're not going to get rushed. There is still, it should be noted, no clear timetable for restarting any of these plants. So up till now, they've shown that they're willing to stand up to the government. At the same time, the government has been careful not to tread too hard. And if they were seen to be riding roughshod over the nuclear regulator, that could cause a backlash for them.
Yeah, you said a moment ago, William, that support in Japan, polls show that it's kind of split 50-50 between pro and anti-nuke. But there was a really growing anti-nuclear movement right after Fukushima. What's become of it?
Well, that came up fairly recently in, surprisingly, the race for the governor of Tokyo. Now, that doesn't have any direct connection to the nation's nuclear policy, but it became a referendum of sorts on that issue because one of the candidates, a former prime minister himself, was running as a clear anti-nuclear candidate. He did disappointingly in the poll itself, and some people say that that has helped to embolden the prime minister to go ahead now with this long-term energy plan. So the nuclear movement has been strong, but hasn't really been able to coalesce, it seems.
William Sposato of The Wall Street Journal speaking with us from Tokyo. Thanks for your time.
Sure. Thank you.
Myanmar is a country undergoing many changes. Its government is allowing limited reforms after decades of strict military rule. Still, change comes in many forms in this place, also known as Burma. For example, walk down a street in downtown Yangon, and you might notice a small Jewish star above some old storefronts. It's the city's old synagogue. Turns out Burma's Jewish community, which had been decimated, is now starting to come back. Naomi Gingold has a story from Yangon.
It's been almost 50 years since regular services were held at Congregation Mesmua Yeshua. But every morning, Sammy Samuel's 63-year-old Father Moses, patriarch of Burma's remaining Jewish community, opens the synagogue doors and waits for any visitors, Jewish or not, who may come by.
The street that we're walking now is called Mahabandula.
Sammy's dad got throat cancer 2 years ago, so Sammy's become the voice of Burma's Jews. And at 32, he's also the youngest of Burma's Jews.
And this street has many, many Jewish stores and lawyers, doctors, all in this main street. So
at its peak, the prosperous Jewish community numbered about 2,500. Most came from Baghdad during British colonial times. Burma's then capital, Rangoon, even had a Jewish mayor in the early 1900s. But when Japan invaded during World War II, most Jews fled. Some returned after the war, and in 1948, when Burma gained independence, its government became fast friends with another new country, Israel.
All of these major high officials, David Ben-Gurion, Moshe Dayan, Golden Meir, visited here, the synagogue, and also the country. And also, not many people know, Burmese Prime Minister UNU was the first highest official to visit Israel after Israel got independent. It was not the United States, it was not the UK, and at that time, Burma was not like today. It was one of the great countries, not just in the Southeast Asia, in Asia.
But that changed in 1962, when the Burmese military toppled the government and nationalized businesses. Burma became a pariah state. Remaining Jews fled in droves, but Sammy's family stayed. Growing up, the only Jewish friends Sammy had were his sisters.
Being Jewish here, sometimes you feel lonely.
In 2002, Sammy got a full scholarship to go to college in the U.S. He moved almost permanently to New York, but every summer he'd come back to Yangon. On a Friday evening one summer, Sammy had a brilliant idea.
I hear the song, the praise song that I'm so familiar with. It's not from the Buddhist, not from the Muslim. It's coming out from the synagogue. It's a Lekha Dodi. And when I got to the synagogue, I saw about 40 American tourists. And they were all praying here. And then my father was so happy. He opened up all these kosher wine that he has. That night was special.
Sammy thought if those 40 Jewish tourists would come for Friday night services, maybe more would come too. So he started a travel agency called Myanmar Shalom to, as he puts it, keep the Jewish spirit alive in Burma. In 2011, Burma became nominally democratic, and tourists started pouring in. Myanmar Shalom, which does group and personalized tours for Jews and non-Jews, has gone from 2 employees to 20.
You know, I have to give Sammy credit, all kinds of credit, because when we first started this project out, he always talked about going back to Myanmar and starting business. And I said, Sammy, I don't think it's in the cards.
That's Frances Wenig, head of the U.S. ASEAN Business Council Institute.
You know, I do not think, even in my lifetime, that it's going to open up. And he was right and I was wrong.
The organization just finished synagogue renovations, and now that Myanmar Shalom can cover costs, handed back synagogue upkeep to the Samuels family.
Every time I go to the synagogue now, as opposed to the past, you know, there are people there. And as Myanmar opens up, I think lots of different people are going to come, including Jews. It's just going to take time.
Myanmar Shalom is not only easing the way for tourists. Sammy now also runs a consulting company for Fortune 100 businesses trying to tap into Burma's untouched and promising markets. And those businesses are bringing with them Jews, who are moving to Yangon for work opportunities much like their ancestors did. This past December, local Jews gathered at the synagogue to celebrate the last night of Hanukkah. Sammy thanked everyone for coming. The community, he pointed out, is growing. Slowly, but growing. It was the most Jews Sammy had ever seen at a local Hanukkah celebration. For The World, I'm Naomi Gingold, Yangon, Myanmar.
Time now for our regular segment on global chefs and tastemakers in New York City. Barbara Sibley is the chef and owner of La Palapa Cocina Mexicana in New York, but she was born and raised in Mexico. Her parents were American expats who fell in love with Mexico and decided to stay. At college, Sibley studied anthropology. Maybe that's why she's so interested in the roots of modern Mexican cuisine, especially the role played by Mexican convents.
I grew up in Mexico City near a convent called the Convento del Carmen. It's one of the main places in the south of Mexico City in San Angel, where I grew up. And the convents sell the host. And they would make the host, which is used for communion, in large sheets, like the size of a letter-sized piece of paper. And then they would punch out the circles. And then at the convents, you could buy large bags of the leftover edges. It's paper-thin, white, has a sort of a slightly doughy, sweet flavor, and it was an incredible treat to get these bags. And it was also very mysterious because you'd walk to the door of the convent and a little gate would open and this hand would come out with this plastic bag full of these bits. When you think about convents and convent kitchens in Mexico, you start with the pre-Columbians, before the Spaniards came. When they came and they colonized Mexico, they needed then a place for women. And actually the convents and the monasteries were often placed along the roads and they were sort of safe havens. as well as places where they were evangelizing and teaching the native Mexicans about Catholicism. So what ended up happening is that they all grew. They grew into schools and then cultural centers as well. And the kitchens became more and more elaborate, culminating at the end of the viceregal period, which is in the 1820s, with a recipe for chiles en nogada, which is a recipe that comes from the Convento de Santa Monica, which is one of the most famous recipes in Mexican history. It's a chili pepper, a poblano. It's stuffed with pork and beef and many sweets, raisins, candied cactus, pine nuts, almonds, apples, pears, peaches, things like this. It's delicious. And then it's covered with fresh cheese and walnut nogada cream. And then it's garnished with pomegranate seeds and parsley. And so it's the colors of the Mexican flag, and this is at the beginning of Mexico's independence, and so the colors of the flag are very important. Mexico is very proud of what they call the mestizaje, mixing. There's even a plaza in Mexico City of the Tres Culturas. It has a pyramid, a colonial church, and a skyscraper. So this mestizaje, the food of Mexico that we really think of daily as the food of Mexico, whether it's like huachinango a la veracruzana or even enchiladas or mole, really originated in most of the convents, the really complex moles, the mole poblano, the mole negro. You have chilies that are completely indigenous to Mexico. You have nuts, such as peanuts, that are completely indigenous. You also have almonds that are completely brought in by the Spaniards. You have sesame seeds, which is ajonjolí, which is brought through the Arab influence in Spain to the Americas. And you have spices such as cloves, which come through the spice trail, and cinnamon from Sri Lanka. So you have in a mole all of these together, and so really a mole is a perfect example of something that's come out of the kitchens of the convents that is completely synonymous with Mexico.
That was New York chef Barbara Sibley on the history of Mexico's convent kitchens. We also have Sibley's recipe for stuffed poblano chilies at PRI.org. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Okay, Anaheim in California means Disneyland, right? But the city also has one of the largest Arab-American communities in the U.S., and yet not that many people outside Anaheim seem to know that. That's why there's a push in Anaheim to recognize and promote that part of town. But as Josie Huang of KPCC reports, not everyone is on board.
16 million. That's about how many people trek to Anaheim to visit Disneyland every year. But few know about a different world just miles away. We're on Brookhurst Street, a long strip in Anaheim, and a hub for people from all over the Middle East. It's where you can go pray at the mosque or hit a hookah lounge. College students gather to smoke through water pipes. There's also shopping with stores selling everything from fluffy pita bread to Middle Eastern desserts.
Okay, so this is the Mecca of all food.
That's Raida Hamida. She takes me down the halal meat aisle.
You have very acquired tastes like lamb tongue, kidneys. I know they have brains here. Oh, here it is.
Every part of the lamb is used.
Yes, nothing is wasted.
Hamida was born in the U.S. Her parents are Palestinian immigrants. And as a kid in the 80s, she saw people from places like Jordan, Egypt, and Syria settle in this part of Anaheim, opening shops and restaurants and eventually turning it into one of the largest Arab-American communities in the U.S., or as people here nickname it, Little Arabia. Hamida says now it's time to get that name formally recognized.
We want to share our culture. We want to celebrate our culture with everyone that lives here.
This is not a ghetto that we're creating.
Community activist Rashad Al-Dabag has teamed up with Hamida to push for the official designation.
We want to make sure that the Arab Americans here are integrated and also that other residents see us as part of Anaheim. We're their neighbors.
Al-Dabag says carving out a sharper identity for the community would benefit all businesses in the area, not just Arab-owned ones.
When you're driving on a freeway and you see a sign that says Little Arabia, you know, that attracts more people, that attracts more attention.
The idea seems to be getting traction with city leaders. In a recent speech, Anaheim's Mayor Tom Tate said he wants to market the area.
Whether you're stopping by the olive tree for delicious lamb or picking up some baklava at Papa Hassan's, Little Arabia gives visitors a different experience than a typical convention city.
California, the U.S. for that matter, is already home to many officially recognized ethnic enclaves. Your Koreatowns, Chinatowns, Little Italys. But not everyone in Anaheim supports a Little Arabia. Andre Beck is a retired engineer who's lived in Anaheim for 50 years. I met him after a neighborhood council meeting, and he's speaking out against the proposed name.
No one feels comfortable on Brookhurst in those businesses. They have their own way of doing things, and they kind of ignore you. And that's part of the problem we have. They just don't want to meld in with the community.
Beck says, why promote a part of town where he's never felt welcome himself?
We're a little concerned and a little bit afraid of what they might do if they get a hold of the community. And we don't want that. We want the community to stay the same.
Mita says she's heard this sentiment before.
And hearing that is very painful because, you know, we don't want anyone to be intimidated by us. We actually are afraid that people are going to be afraid of us.
To smooth relations, Hamida this month invited neighborhood leaders to lunch at a Lebanese restaurant with Arab American business people and the mayor. She calls it the Shawarma Summit, a step toward building trust and friendships. Maybe one day, she says, an official Little Arabia will be something everyone supports. For the World, I'm Josie Huang, Anaheim, California.
And finally, my thoughts turn to legendary guitarist Paco de Lucia. He passed away apparently after suffering a heart attack on a beach in Mexico. He was 66. First time I heard de Lucia was way back, perhaps the same way you discovered him, on this recording. Paco de Lucia performing there with jazz guitarist Al Dimiola. That 1981 recording of Friday Night in San Francisco was my introduction to de Lucia and the style he innovated, Nuevo Flamenco. In the years since, I was lucky to see Paco de Lucia several times in concert, interviewed him a couple of times too, even had his number programmed into my phone, and had the unfortunate experience of accidentally pocket-dialing him in Spain a few times in the middle of the night. But it was about 2 years ago that I finally met him in person. That evening, before his concert in Boston, he reflected on his life in music and what started it all.
I was a very poor guy. My aspiration in life was to survive. And I think I have the idea that the people who suffer has more creativity than the people who has everything, you know? I spend my time all over the world, you know? I am traveling from 12 years old that I came to this country, playing with a ballet of Jose Greco. Jose Greco was a very well-known dancer. And I came with my brother Pepe. He was a singer, and I played the guitar. I was a kid, and we spent 1 year touring in a bus all over the United States. From that time till now, I didn't stop. I am tired, many years non-stop, but it's the only way I have to communicate with the people. I play music, and with the music you can go anywhere. I have the sensation that I should like to have another life in a way, you know, because I should like to learn, for example, harmonies and music. If I should have now 20 years old, I would come to Boston, to Berkeley, to learn harmonies, you know. I don't read music. Everything I did it through my intuition.
Despite his desire to have a proper musical training, whatever that is, Paco de Lucia was one of those rare musicians who not only created his art through intuition, he used his intuition to create a new musical form, Nuevo Flamenco. We'll leave you with one slice of that legacy, Paco de Lucia's timeless collaboration with one of his great musical partners, the flamenco singer Camarón de la Isla, another who died too young. This is the title track from a recording of theirs titled Potro de Rabia y Miel. That's our program today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at ritaallen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.